This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 210, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 200 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Dev Rooney about her book, UFO Investigator, A Personal Look into Circumstance, Investigations, and Discovery. Dev is a longtime UFO researcher, investigator, and author known for her work with MUFON and her book, UFO Investigator. She has appeared on numerous podcasts and TV shows. Hi, Dev. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called UFO Investigator, A Personal Look into Circumstance, Investigations, and Discovery. First thing I want to ask, there's this sentence I saw in your book that said, "My interest in UFOs came suddenly after an incident in the summer of 69.
Well, I was 11 years old that summer. You know, I was a normal kid, and where we lived, the house had this big tree in the front yard, and I always would climb it and hang out in there, spying on all the kids in the neighborhood, you know, just playing around. This happened in Newark, California, which is in the Bay Area. And it's a typical summer, you know, being up there every day, and I was very tall and thin. So, you know, I was in the two, you know, kind of had myself wedged in the two main branches. And there was really no danger of falling out or anything like that. But one day, I found myself waking up, like coming into consciousness, about 6 feet away from the tree. But I knew that that moment before, I was up in the tree. And yet, I was waking up, and I sat up, and I looked over at the tree like, wait, what happened? So I got up and quickly brushed myself off and was really puzzled by the fact that I was on the ground. I was waking up. So I walked over to the tree, looking up at it, thinking I didn't fall out. And if I did, I would have just fell close to the trunk of the tree. But this tree was actually planted on a man-made mound. It was surrounded by this dark coral rock. It had little holes in it. So it was kind of sharp. And I knew that if I would have fell out of it, I probably would have hit the rock. But I was too far away to have fallen. It really had me perplexed because I was young, but I wasn't stupid. I knew I didn't fall out. So I had actually forgotten about that incident, but I knew at that time that I really got interested in UFOs. That was in 1969. You know, there was a lot of, on like Saturday day, during the day on TV, there'd be all these 1950 movies, you know, programs like Earth versus the Flying Saucers and all these type of alien movies that Hollywood was putting out. And I was just really hooked on them all. And I just wanted to sit and watch them. Of course, my mom, she always used Saturday as the cleaning day and tell me, go outside and play. You know, she didn't want me in there watching TV, and I was begging her to watch them. But I started to climb the roof and just be sitting up there laying, staring at the sky, wondering what was out in space. And so it seemed at that time that I all of a sudden had this huge interest, you know, in aliens and UFOs, to the fact that ever since then, I became obsessed with that whole thing. I tell you, you know, all these decades later, I'm pretty much like not a day goes by I don't think about UFOs. As I started to get older, I wanted to say,
yeah,
shortly after that event, you know, like I would, my mother would say, okay, it's time to go to bed in the evenings. And I would go to bed, and then I'd get up out of bed and I would stand at the window just staring at the sky, the nighttime sky. And I remembered just kind of crying, because tears coming down my face, because I really felt like I had been left behind. And what was interesting was, it wasn't like I was lacking in love or anything from my family. In fact, I loved my family. I had a good family life, a good childhood. And so that was very curious, you know, that I had that feeling of being left behind. And I just always would stare at the nighttime sky, just feeling like that. It was a little bit of a lonely feeling in a sense, which I didn't understand, because it was like, I had three, you know, younger sisters at the time. And so I wasn't a lonely person. I had a mother and a father. And so we had a full family. And so it was very strange. Fast forward into the 70s. And as I got older, I don't usually talk about this because it's kind of personal. But shortly after that event, I started my period for the first time as a young girl, young woman, whatever. And I was having a lot of medical problems with it all. I was very ill. In fact, my grandmother would always tell, because that was my grandmother was my father's mother, and she was always, you know, saying, this isn't right, you know, the amount of pain she's going through. And I was definitely ill. And it wasn't until years and years later when I queried an abductee group on Facebook. And I was asking all the women abductees, you know, to share if they had any female problems. And oh, gosh, I was really evident that a lot of us had gone through some problems. I don't normally talk about this kind of thing. And I left it out of the book, because when I did write the book, I kept wondering if I should put it in there. And I don't know, I felt, well, it's a little on the personal side.
Yeah.
So I left it out of the book. Sometimes I'll bring it up, and, you know, but it is an important aspect to, I believe, to all this. Now, in the 70s, my interest never waned. You know, there was no internet. There was the library. What I found very interesting was in the 70s was the National Enquirer, that magazine that you would see in a grocery store. And they would always just profile all these cases. What was interesting is Travis Walton's case was in there, I remember. And also that Charlie Hickson.
Pascagoula. Yeah.
Yes. They were in there as well. And I would be like, oh, begging my mom, oh, can I have this magazine? Because I wanted to read all about it. I was so fascinated and interested in it. Because, you know, again, there's no internet. If you go to the library, there was, you know, some books, but, you know, not every library had every book on anything that had to do with UFOs, you know. So I would always try to just get anything I could get my hands on just to learn more. I was very fascinated with it. The 80s came. Well, here's the thing. In 1978, or I guess it was, I never wrote anything down. So let's see. In 1978, I was a manager of a gas station, and I was taking the money to the bank, and I had a motorcycle. So I rode the motorcycle to the bank, and this is way before ATMs or anything. So the bank closed at 3, and I needed to get there before 3, so that as a merchant, I needed to put the money into the bank, because, you know, it was a business. So I get to the bank, and I'm a couple minutes late. They had already locked the door, and I'm banging on the door going, hey, remember me, you know, like, because I go there every day. So they let me in, and I did the banking and came back out. Nobody's around. Okay, 3 o'clock, the banks are closed. There's no ATM, so there's nobody going to be driving through anything. I was thinking, oh, it had rained earlier that day, and now the sky is blue. And I thought, okay, I'm off work. This is great. So I'm standing there by my motorcycle. I'm ready to put my helmet on my head when I happened to look up and I saw these two disc-shaped objects coming from the east, flying west towards me. And I'm thinking, what the heck is this? And so I didn't have my helmet on. I actually put it down in, you know, down by my side in my hand. And I'm looking up, watching these two objects. And they did ultimately fly above my head. So I realized at a distance they looked oblong, but when they flew over my head, they were complete circles, circular. And there was no wings, no windows, no nothing. They were just silver in color. And there was two of them. And they weren't flying side by side, but kind of like one a little bit behind the other. And they went right over my head, completely silent. I just watched them fly to the west. And at that time, there was a huge hangar on the other side of the peninsula of where I lived. I don't know if it was NASA or, you know, and I can't remember the name right now, but it was very interesting. And at the time, I didn't know of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, but I was getting a publication from APRO, Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization. So I wrote them, because again, there's no internet. And so I wrote them and asked them for a report, like a paper report, and they sent it to me, and I filled it out and sent it to them about my sighting. Then the 80s came, and I believe it was 1983. I had moved back in with my parents to save some money. I think I was about 24 at the time, 24 years old. It was a two-story house. It was in Newark. And nobody was home. My mother worked, and my dad had just got home, and he was laying on the couch. And my cat, this is what was very strange, is that my cat, I never allowed her outside. She was declawed and all that. But somehow she was outside in the backyard, and I knew that she was, and I had to go get her. And I walked out the door, which, from the house, there was like an outdoor patio section of the house. And then when I opened that door to go to the outdoors, when I walked out, I could hear this very slight hum. And I turned to the right, and there was this huge object just hovering there. And I kind of gasped, which was funny, was because I had never gasped before or since then, except for at that time, because it startled me so. And it was probably about 20 feet away. It was just right there, hovering between the two houses. And from that point of view, I could only see half of it. So what I could see was kind of an oblong shape, kind of like blimp shape object. And I probably saw about 15 feet of it. So it was probably about 30 feet in length. And I'm standing there looking at this thing, and I was very scared because it hit me like, what the heck is this, right? In my mind, it was like, oh, it's the Goodyear blimp. It was like my mind was trying to come up with the answer so that I wouldn't be afraid. And I just went, oh, okay. And in some ways, I knew that, no, that didn't make any sense. But I just wanted to get my cat, which I walked straight to the back fence, and she was standing there. And I picked her up. And then I turned around to face the house, and I just made a beeline. I just wanted to get into the house because I still felt some kind of fear. So am I walking towards the house? Now this object would be on my left side. I wanted to see if it was still there. So I just kind of glanced up, and I saw that it was still there. And I just went in the house. I put the cat down, and I said to my dad, who was just lounging, the TV was on, and he laying on the couch with his eyes closed. And I said, Dad, the Goodyear blimp is going to hit the house. And I couldn't believe I said that because it didn't make any sense. And all he did was go, uh-huh, because he was kind of on his way to sleep. And nobody else was home. My mother was at work. Funny thing is, I don't remember anything after that, which doesn't make any sense because it wasn't late at all. It was probably around 7 o'clock, 7:30, and wasn't late. And for a 24-year-old, that's not late at all. But what was really, when I did remember, because again, I forgot about that incident as well. And then later it, I remembered it. I kept thinking to myself and kind of kicking myself, like, why didn't you go out there and, you know, investigate it, you know, look at it, go under it, you know, just, and yet I was afraid. I just wanted to get out of there. And I, what I did was, after, when I did remember this incident in the early 90s, I called Goodyear. I tried to find out, did they have dirigibles that were that size? Would they be flying them in this, you know, neighborhoods? And they were like, no, we don't have anything that size, that small, and we would never be in a neighborhood. And I said, okay, well, because I just needed to find out, you know, is that, what could that have been possible? But, you know, it didn't really make sense. I think I was just trying to get myself to where I wasn't fearful anymore, and coming up with something that, my mind was coming up with something that would, you know, pacify myself, and knowing that it was something that was identifiable. What was interesting was, in those in that time of my life, in the 80s, the 90s, I was very, very interested in past life regressions. I ended up getting, in the 80s, Blockbuster Video had, I had found this tape. Richard Sutphin, he was a hypnotherapist down in the LA area. I got that and I started experimenting with it, because he would, in the tape, he would put you under and you could explore on your own, you know, your past lives. And I was very successful with that, and it was very fascinating. And his wife, Tara, she would do automatic writing, and I wrote to her and was asking questions about, I was trying to find out more about me. I got some real amazing information through that. So I was into past life regression. I started to find out about out-of-body experiences, because I felt like I was coming out of my body at night. And I could also feel like when I return, it'd be like you could feel yourself being slammed back into the body. So in 1996, I went to the Monroe Institute in Virginia, and for a week there. It was fascinating, very, very fascinating experience, where they taught you how to use tools that you can use to go out of the body. And I really, really loved just experimenting with all kinds of things like that. And when I was at the Monroe Institute, when we got there, they took everybody's watches away. You couldn't have any clocks or anything to tell time, because they were teaching us there was no such thing as time. And so everything we did, from eating to taking a shower to walking outside and grounding ourselves, was they would let us know when that time would be, you know, okay, it's time to go to bed, it's time to do this, it's time to do your exercises in groups. And when you go back into your room, where you had these individual cubbies with electronics to do the experiments and stuff. One day during that week, we were told that we were going to have a special guest, and it turned out to be Joe McMonagle. He was the Army's first remote viewer. So he was going to be there as a guest and kind of teach us how to do this remote viewing. So it was very fascinating. And I would go home after that and try what he had taught us. I found that I was a little pretty successful in doing some rudimentary things. So that was very fascinating.
With the regression and the hypnosis, you did some, didn't you, to look at your UFO experiences?
In 1990... I had a subscription to UFO Magazine, which was being published from the LA area. And in 1990, one of the issues, they were profiling a local hypnotherapist. Her name was Helen Billings. And I thought, ooh, you know, I would love to go to a hypnotherapist and try to find out what happened when I was 11. And I figured if they're profiling her, then she would be open-minded to the whole UFO thing. And I didn't want to just go to just anybody. So in 1990, I did go see her. So she made me feel really comfortable and was going through the regression to put me under. And basically, I was being blocked. Like, I couldn't see anything. Like, I couldn't go, you know, she was trying to get me to go back to that time frame and, you know, find out what happened. I was just being blocked. I couldn't see anything. I was seeing black. And she said, well, I think she got me out of it. And she said, well, I think you're being blocked by something, or it could be your, you know, it could be you trying to protect your mind. And she said, well, let me try something else. So she put me back under and she asked me a question. She said, when's the first time you've seen a UFO? Well, I knew the answer, but that's not what I said. I started to talk about the canoe people. And she started asking me questions about that. And it was basically, these people came from the stars. And they came in a cylindrical object that we called the canoe. Well, we call them canoe people because they came in a very long cylindrical object that we could only refer or you know, it just seemed that it was the only thing that we could associate that with is a canoe, long. I could see this cylindrical object on the desert floor, and I was standing up on a ledge looking down, and I realized I was a Native American boy. And she had said, oh, well, you know, she was trying to find out when this was, and I think it was in the early 1800s. And, but it's so funny, as I was looking down at myself in that lifetime, I just had this like loincloth, but I knew how it was made and everything. It was just very interesting. And, I was the chief's son, and I told her that, the canoe people would come and talk to my father. And as I'm hearing myself talk about this, I've just thought that was just amazing. I'm just like, wow. And she asked me an interesting question. She said, who do you know in this life that you knew back then? And immediately I said, oh, my nephew Anthony was my baby brother then. And she said, I think she asked me how, you know, I felt about him. And I said, I love him. I started crying. And I got emotional, and it brought me out of the regression. And I was startled by how I just woke up out of that. And then I was a little embarrassed that I was crying. I said, I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm crying. She goes, no. You know, emotion is very real because you love him. And I said, yeah, I do. And so it was very, that was the very first time I'd ever been under hypnosis. And it was, very interesting. And she was just explaining to me, because I says, well, you know, like, how do I know that that was real? And she said, well, your emotions, you know, that those are not, that's not a lie, that's coming from, you know, you're remembering another lifetime and, you know, the love that you have for this person who you've been in, you know, another lifetime with, that never dies. And so it made a lot of sense to me. But we really didn't get through the block. And so she said, she asked me a final question. She said, can I ask you, are you ready to know the truth? And I said, no, not really. I was afraid. I didn't know what to expect. And I really wasn't sure, you know, like if I really wanted to at that time. So I went away with that. But I felt that that was a success based on the fact that me reliving that lifetime and seeing what I saw just was so real. And then the emotion that I felt for my nephew, who obviously I've had a past life with, I felt that was all a success. So through, you know, time is going on and I'm having UFO sightings and stuff and other paranormal activities happening. Very strange. I was becoming very psychic too. Like I would always know things that would happen. Started experimenting with, like I love this story. I love telling this. Is in the 90s, a friend of mine, we were, I think it was a Saturday. And I told her, I said, look, I said, I really need a new bed. And I want to go to Tahoe, Lake Tahoe, because there was casinos up there. And I says, I want to be able to gamble and get some money to buy a new bed. And she goes, well, I don't have any money. And I said, well, that's okay. I have $20. And she kind of laughed at me because she said, well, that's not enough money. And I said, well, I have a full tank of gas and all we have to do is get up there. And I said, but do me a favor. I said, take a moment and with me envision, you know, that I'm going to win this money. Because I always felt that more than one person, you know, seeing something happen can manifest, right? In a sense. So she said, all right. So anyway, we drove up there with $20 and I told her just pack an overnight bag. And she's like, all right. So then we go up there. I had such a bad headache because my neck was out. That was another thing why I needed a new bed was just it was hard to sleep at night. And we get up there and it's lunchtime and she's like, oh, what are we going to do for food? And I says, well, let's get a hot dog and a drink. So I bought that with the $20. That left me $4 to gamble, which is not a lot of money, especially because I like to play dollar machines. And you have to pretty much put $3 in to get any kind of big, you know, jackpot. So she just kind of looked at me sideways like, okay. Anyway, so I told her, okay, I need to be alone. Because what I would do and what I didn't know then was I would put myself in a light trance. I would soften my focus. And as I walked down by the casino, the machines, I would then know which machine to pick. So that's what I would do. I would kind of soften my focus, walk, and then look at the machines. And I could actually put all that noise like behind me in a sense where like I don't even hear the background din, you know, like I don't hear anything. And I chose this machine on the end and I thought, okay, this is the one. So I have $4 and I got the dollars because back in those days, it wasn't digital like it is now. And so I got the dollars and I put in three, pulled the handle. I think I got a cherry and it gave me a couple bucks and then did that a couple times. And I kept getting like one or two more. And then I looked over at the machine next to me and I thought, oh no, that looks like the exact same one. So I started to doubt myself. So I moved over to the next machine. I put in $3, pulled the handle and I got another cherry. And I heard myself say, no, 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 no. You need to go back to the original machine on the end. So I moved over. All right. So now I have about $5 left. And I put in $3, pulled a handle, and I won $10,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The machine's going ding, 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 ding. And I'm just like, oh, I got such a headache. I'm so sick. It kind of makes me nauseous, right? And because my neck was out, it was just, and these random people are coming up to me saying, oh, congratulations. And I'm like, oh, yeah, thank you. And then I'm kind of looking around for the girl that's going to give me my money, right? And then I get the money. Here comes my friend. She's walking and I'm like, come here, come here. She said, what's going on? And I go, well, I won. She goes, oh, what did you win? And I go, 10,000. She goes, 10,000 what? And I go, dollars. She, her eyes popped out of her head, like, what? And I go, yeah. And I go, look, we need to get a hotel room because I need to lay down. I am sick and I need to get some aspirin. So, you know, we did that and we get in the car. I says, you're going to have to drive. Cause well, the hotel that we were in, the casino hotel, was already booked because this was June and everybody was getting married. And so there was no vacancy. And I said, we need to get in the car and drive wherever to get a hotel room. And yeah, so we ended up finding somewhere and I just slept the night through. But it was amazing because I was able to do these kind of things where this wasn't the only time that I was able to pick a machine and it would win. So I had this, I don't know, this ability, this psychic ability. And then I was having a lot of paranormal instances going on. I think I told it in the book is that that same friend of mine, we went to stay in a, like on the coast, went to stay at a place. It was strange because we got there late and it was at night and she was a smoker and there was like an outdoor patio and I walked out here and I said, oh, here's an ashtray for you. And it was dark. You could see the nighttime sky. You could hear the ocean, but you couldn't see it because it was so dark out. And we were looking up at the sky and she says, oh, look. And there was an object that was going by. And I looked at it. She looked at it. She said, oh, look, they followed you here. I said, don't say that. Well, that night went to sleep and I got woken up in the middle of the night by this smell, sulfur or something. I don't know. I was trying to identify because it just woke me up out of sleep. And I sat up and I said, what is that smell? She said, what? I turn on a light and I go, what, do you smell that? She goes, well, maybe it's a skunk that got in here. I go, that doesn't make any sense. How can it get in here? And I'm looking around. What was strange was on the right-hand side of the wall, there was like these very thin windows and a white, bright light was right in the middle of in one of them. And I thought, oh, the moon must be out. But what was so funny was it was perfectly in the middle of that very thin, thin window. And I thought, how interesting, you know, but now I'm wondering if it was the moon at all. Well, went back to sleep again in the middle of the night, woke up to what I thought was glass breaking. And I sat up and I said, what was that? And I turned on the light and I started to look around the room for something that broke, like glass, but everything was made out of wicker furniture and there was no glass. All the windows were intact. I thought, oh, maybe it was the ice bucket, but all the ice was melted. Nothing was broken. And I decided, well, maybe the ashtray out on the patio thing broke or something. I looked out the window, nothing. And I thought it was strange. And I started to get this overwhelming fear to where I almost didn't want to shut the lights off. She kept saying, oh my God, I'm not getting any sleep tonight. Close the light. And I'm like, all right. And I'm just like standing there going, I don't want to close the light. So I said, all right. So I close the light, get into bed. And I'm laying there in the dark and I'm thinking, I have my eyes closed and the fear is mounting and I feel like there's somebody there and I'm laying on my back and I kind of have the covers up by my head, you know, because I don't want to see anything. And I said, oh God, there's somebody here. And I decided, okay, just take a look. And I opened my eyes and at the foot of the bed was a small, dark, hooded figure. And I'm just looking at it and I can't see a face. And I just felt a lot of fear and I just closed my eyes really tight. Then I just felt like there was like white behind my eyes. And then I just must have passed out because the next day it was time to get up. And I just said, oh, I said, that was a freaky night. She goes, yeah, I didn't get much sleep. And I said, look, I don't want to take a shower. I just want to get out of here. And she goes, yeah. I go, well, grab a muffin and just get out of here. Well, it was a beautiful day. And get in the car, and I'm driving, and we're on a very small road, kind of like, a two-way road. Nobody's around, and it's a beautiful morning. And she said, look, let's not stop till we get to Petaluma, which was probably an hour away. I said, okay, because I knew she was freaked out. So we sat in silence, and I remember driving, and there's no one around. And I looked down at the speedometer and then looked back up, and now there's a car in front of me. And I said, hey, where did that car come from? She goes, well, I don't know. And I go, well, there's no roads leading to this road. Where did it come from? She goes, I don't know. And I go, oh, God. So I don't know what happened there, but that's not the first time that ever happened where, you know, there's this kind of like a time slip where, you know, that I can't explain where this car came from. But we just got out of there, and it was very freaky night and didn't get much sleep. But that was in the early 90s, and still seeing UFOs or whatever. I would say a lot of paranormal stuff at home and everything.
With the paranormal stuff at home, this wasn't then related to UFOs. It was other stuff.
Paranormal activity seems to go hand in hand, you know, with the UFO phenomenon. There's a lot of things that go hand in hand with UFOs. And when I do investigations, if there is close encounters, I'll always ask certain questions, like, you know, if they experience paranormal activity in their homes, like right after seeing a UFO. And sometimes they don't realize that it's connected, and they'll go, oh, that's funny that you ask. And then start telling me stuff that was going on that same night. That's what a lot of people don't understand, is that these do go hand in hand. You know, even Whitley Strieber talks about seeing, you know, dead relatives or whatever. But, you know, the paranormal stuff where you start hearing like as though someone's in the other room, then you get up and you go out there and there's no one around, stuff coming on by itself. What was really interesting was I was living in Fremont and in an apartment, and I had bought a house and it was getting built at that time in another county. One night, the funny thing is that there has been, you know, like entities coming in, and I could feel them sitting on the bed, that kind of thing. And one night I'm laying on my right hand side, looking out the door of the bedroom into the hall, and it's dark, and I'm trying to just relax and go to sleep because I had to get up early to go to work. And I'm laying there, and in my mind's eye, I could see people mulling around in the hall. And it looked like a party. Like there was all these people just walking around, talking, and it looked like a party, like they were celebrating something. Later on, I had asked a psychic about that. And they said, oh, they were celebrating the fact that you were getting a new house. And I said, oh, okay, because it really looked like they were these people that were just having a good time. And I had to ultimately close the bedroom door because it was keeping me awake, you know, just stuff like that. And there's other little things, but that was major because I had never seen, you know, so many people like that, just, you know, in a situation. So And then, of course, I moved into my new house in 2000, and stuff was still going on. I was having like this little owl coming in to visit me at night out in the front yard. I was standing out in the front yard because I was looking at the tree that the county had planted in front of my house. And I had wondered, why do they do that without, you know, like asking us, what did we want? And I'm standing out there looking at this little tree, and it was dark and the street light was on. And I noticed that there was an owl standing on the grass looking at me. And I thought, oh, how cute, you know? And I was just staring at it, and it was very strange because that weekend, it was a weekend, and I had a premonition to want to get in the car and drive out where there's no city lights. And I did park on the side of the road by this orchard because I wanted to look at the nighttime sky. And there were these in the trees of the orchard as I'm standing out there in the middle of nowhere, practically. These, like, I thought they were eyes in the trees. And I thought, what is this? And it kind of was a little unnerving. I didn't know what I was looking at. And I just thought, well, maybe I better get in the car and get out of here. And I had asked my aunt, I said, are there fireflies out here? And she laughed at me and said, no, we don't have fireflies out here. I said, oh. And she goes, why? And I said, oh, because I thought I saw these little lights in the trees. I go, but they were kind of more like eyes, but that doesn't make any sense. And she just kind of looked at me because she too has seen UFOs, her and my uncle. So that was always a subject that we'd bring up and talk about. But again, in my backyard, I'd like to go out and, look at the sky. And this owl would be sitting on top of the wall, the back wall, just staring at me. So that was the only time of my life that I had an owl just showing up staring at me. You know, obviously there's an association with owls with all this too. So I always felt that was very interesting that always came about. But and only at that time, I only lived in that house for 4 years, but there was a lot of incidents going on in that house as well. But so I ended up moving to Oregon. I became the chief investigator for MUFON up there, and I was having UFO sightings there as well. Pretty interesting. Like, I had gotten a car accident in 2008, I believe it was, and I had hurt my neck, and so I was sitting on the couch, and I heard jets going over, and it was about 9 o'clock at night. And I had a premonition that they were chasing something. I was too hurt to get up and go outside. But the next night, around the same time, there was another jet that went over, and they're loud. I said, you need to get up and go out there. And so I did. And I'm standing in the parking lot there, looking probably northwest, and there were these three red lights in a horizontal pattern. And I was thinking, what's that? And I couldn't hear the jets anymore, but I seen these lights and now they're coming towards me. This thing ended up flying right over my head. It was huge. I did hear some kind of light mechanical sound, but underneath it was like seven to red colored lights in a triangular pattern underneath this object. And this thing was, I couldn't see the edges of it because it blended in with the nighttime sky, but it was low. I felt like I could throw a rock and hit it. That's how low it was, because I was living up on a kind of a hill. and it just flew to the east, and I lost sight of it. But it was massive, and it was very low. Ultimately, UFO case came in, and it was only about a mile and a half from me. A guy was outside smoking a cigarette. I went to his house to do the live investigation, and that same night, he saw the jets chasing some object. So that was kind of like a second, like, witness to whatever was going on. So it was very interesting. I ended up moving back home to Northern California in 2010. But prior to that, when I was up in Oregon, MUFON had a special project that was called the SIP project. It was the Star Impact Project, and it was being funded by Robert Bigelow. That's what we were told at the time. And every state had the option to be a part of this if you wanted. And so my state director in Oregon, he signed us up. And so I wanted to be a part of that. And I had to fill out an application. So I became the only SIP investigator for Oregon. And then I also got hired to be one of the dispatch for the database. And these were they paid money. So that was really exciting to be able to get paid for that. Because, we're a non-profit organization. So that was the only time that we were getting paid to do something like this back then because of it being funded. But it was amazing. I learned a lot, and I was deployed about three times. Yeah, it was pretty interesting because one of the times I was in being deployed, I had to drive 3 hours south to do an investigation. And the witness was a man of the cloth. He had a sighting of a bunch of objects that were in the sky. But that same night, he had taken his dog out in the front yard to do its business. And he realized his dog was getting very frightened, and it was like wrapping itself around his legs. And he was wondering what was wrong. Saw that the dog was looking across the street, and there was an alien by a fence. And but he was an experiencer. He had lots of experiences and sightings. And so when I went there, I interviewed him and his wife, and even she was telling me that there was an alien outside their window. And so they were having a lot of experiences, and it was quite an investigation because, there was an entity that was actually seen right across the street from him. And not only the fact that there was a bunch of UFOs in the sky. So I went back to my hotel, and my plan was to go back out there at night because I went there during the day so I can do measurements and find out how far away things were. And, you can see things better in the day. So my plan was to go back to the hotel after I ended the investigation with them, have a little dinner, and then go back when it got dark and sit out there and see if I could see anything. That was my plan. And I was never afraid of, going out on live investigations at night or anything by myself. But after having dinner and being in the room and just waiting for darkness, I had this overwhelming fear. And I just couldn't shake it. And it was just unnerving. And I called my STAR team manager and I said, "Hey, look, I'm out here on the live investigation." He said, "Well, how's it going?" And I said, "Well, I already finished the investigation, but my plan was to go out there once it got dark and then do like a stakeout, like sit out there and see if I could see anything." Because this guy is a repeat and, experiencer. So he said, "Well, I don't really like you going out by yourself." And I said, "Well, I've done it before. I'll be fine. But here's the thing. The reason why I'm calling you is I have this overwhelming fear that I don't even want to close the light off, shut the light off here in the room or anything. And he goes, are you still wanting to go out there? And I go, no, because I don't know. I just have this horrible fear. And he says, well, I don't want you to go out there. He goes, just stay put, get a good night's rest, and then just leave in the morning and go home, you know, because you did your job. But I was disappointed, number one. And number two, I just couldn't shake the fear. And I didn't know where the fear was coming from. So either I had a premonition of something that would have happened, and, you know, I'm alone. And so that really kept me from going out there. So that is something I never forgot. So that was in Oregon.
Do you think you have some kind of, I don't know, premonition or pre-warning, like something about you senses that they might be coming?
Yes, because I actually, where I'm living right now, I live in an apartment and I have a balcony that faces due east. Several years ago, I was out on the patio cooking steaks. I'm just standing there looking out because there's fields out this way. I knew I was going to see a UFO. I knew it beforehand. And I was looking around and it wasn't dark yet. It was dusk. The sky was still blue, bluish, you know. And I knew ahead of time. And so my roommate and I said, hey, why don't you come out here and look at your steak? And then I said, because, you know, and I have mine a lot more well done. So she'd come back out and I said, hey, I think I'm going to see a UFO. She said, what? And she's seen UFOs with me, so she knows. And I go, well, look at your steak. So she did. And then I looked up and there were two white lights in the sky, just stationary. And I said, hey, look, look. And so she goes, oh my God. And I go, well, what are you seeing? And I go, are those two separate lights or is that connected to something? I'm trying to tell because it started to get darker. And she goes, no, those are two lights that are connected to something. And I go, okay. And so the two white lights are horizontal from each other. They brighten and then dim. And then you could see that they're moving away. It's moving away, whatever it is. And I go, look, look, it's moving. And she goes, yep, it's moving away. And I go, she's like, oh my God. And I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. And she said, you knew that you were going to see that? I said, yeah, ahead of time.
It's like a spidey sense.
Yeah, I mean, and I really believe that fear that came over me when I was in Grants Pass, Oregon, on that investigation was just something telling me to just stay put. And if something would have happened, maybe not in a good way, I'm kind of glad I didn't go out there because I was all alone. You know, I'm 3 hours away from home and, you know, in a town I've never been in before. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I think that there was something telling me to just stay put.
The book's called UFO Investigator, A Personal Look into Circumstance, Investigations, and Discovery. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and do you have a website?
We have a northerncaliforniamufon.com.
Great. And we didn't even get a chance to really talk about your experience with MUFON, did we?
Well, I talked a little bit about the SIP project that I was involved with, MUFON, but in which was, I think, unique because that only happened once. And it was fascinating and it was really fantastic to get paid. So at that time.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
That was an interview with Dev Rooney about her book, UFO Investigator, A Personal Look into Circumstance, Investigations, and Discovery. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. If you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my new book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favorite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.